Welcome to the Revenue Lounge, a podcast for revenue operations professionals who want to understand the various facets of this important go-to-market function. In each episode, the team at Nectar interviews revenue warriors on how they are reimagining revenue operations in creative and disruptive ways, and what are their secrets to building a scalable and predictable revenue engine. Let's get started.
Customer success is more than just a support function. It's a strategic pillar for growth. The challenge lies in how these teams can maximize customer engagement, foster key relationships, and uncover new revenue opportunities without losing sight of the customer's needs. Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Revenue Lounge podcast. I am your host, Randy Likas. And in today's episode, we will dive into actionable strategies that help customer success teams take a more proactive approach role in accelerating growth and engagement, ensuring that revenue becomes a natural outcome of deep, meaningful relationships. And joining me today is Daniel Silverstein. Daniel is the VP of Customer Success and Head of Business at Carta. With over 15 years of successful sales and account management experience, Daniel specializes in combining passion for motivating people with an expertise in creating, developing, and growing revenue streams. Daniel, thank you so much for joining us today.
No, thanks for having me. Good to be here.
So, Dan, can you tell us a little bit about your current role at Carta? Mm-hmm. And for those who might not know who Carta is, just a couple sentences on Carta's business.
Yeah, I'm happy to do that. Well, I'll start with that first. Most people listening to this probably know either directly or in some adjacent way what Carta is. Carta is mostly known here, and this, I think, will change over time in the future as we build out our future strategy of what we're working on here. But we are largely known as the cap table management software company. In other words, we are the source of truth for equity ownership for at the company level and for the shareholder level. So if you are a holder of equity, you can track your holdings in there and exercise and understand the implications of exercising. If you are the company who owns that cap table, so to speak, you can administer equity and control all the outcomes of cap table, including the dilution of the ownership of the cap table and the outcomes if you were to exit and move your business into a different direction. So we are this central source of truth for equity administration for private companies on the cap table side. So what I do here is I look after the post-sales organization for that cap table part of our business. It's about 30,000 customers. That includes customer success, implementation, support. We have an in-house customer education, enablement, and strategy team, and then an operations team with our liquidity side of the business that runs tender offers and secondaries.
Fantastic. And you've been there for close to 5 years?
Actually, over, almost six.
Almost 6 years.
Yeah, I started here at the beginning of 2019, so coming up on 6 years.
Yeah, so in that 6 years, lots of changes in market dynamics and things that have happened, right? So
a couple times, two or three times, yeah.
So maybe walk us through a little bit about what the customer success function has evolved over the past couple of years.
Sure, yeah, happy to do that. Maybe it might be helpful, especially for this audience, to know that my background prior to Carta, a mixture of new business and existing business. Kind of, I've held the title of director of sales multiple times in some of those places that's included pre and post sales. So the challenge that I was brought here to present and solve and create a work stream for was the post sales organization at Carta was five folks waiting for the phone to ring, very reactionary. In some cases, like, you know, solving a problem and maybe even selling them something, but not really knowing how to do it again and how to repeat it and make it a part of the everyday job here. So I was brought here to build the full sort of end-to-end post-sales strategy for the company, but also really in the eyes of who is now our CRO and our CFO at the time, can you also get some more money? Can you figure out how to do this in a way that is good for the customer and also good for Carta? So it was really spent the first year, or almost two full years here, building out that motion. How do you cover customers end-to-end from a segment perspective? How do you provide the right lifecycle moments? And also, how do you think about upsell and expansion for what was 7,000 or 8,000 customers at the time, growing to where we are today at 30,000 or so? Wow. Trying to find the right lifecycle engagement opportunities and building while you're growing, hitting revenue targets, carrying quota, trying to contribute to the company's top-line growth, while also figuring out ways to think about NDR and retention and more bottom-line, longer-term strategies. So I spent that first couple of years working on that problem alone. Had a wild, successful first year. We beat the quota by $1 million in the first year, which got us, I would call, the investment opportunity to keep building more and getting more of the end-to-end, like how you think about how CSM and implications and support interact with each other. And then eventually those functions came into my world as well. So I got the chance to build more of a lifecycle build-based motion across all the teams where we have handoffs between implementations and CSM and support and then support and secondaries and all the different life cycle moments that happen here.
Oh, that's great. It's certainly a lot of changes happen, right? And both in terms of what you've done, but the growth, right? As far as the customer growth, how do you organize your customer success function as far as segments and ownership of the revenue? And what I mean by that is certain people own the renewals, certain people do account management through Farm for Growth. How does the organizational structure look?
Yeah, initially I would say it was more of what you would look like as a traditional account management function where we were, all commercial stuff has always gone through our team. That has always been true. We've always done renewals here. And so that's always been a responsibility and probably will always be that way. It was a brief period of time where we experimented with a small renewals function and team, but it was really only for enterprise and it didn't last very long. So I would say initially for the first 3 or 4 years, more like AM, commercial responsibility, upsell quotas, and also retention at the same time, but really largely more what you would think of as an AM function. Over the last couple of years, we moved into more of a like CSM NDR focus, where the team is focusing more on the retention parts of NDR than the upsell. Mm-hmm. We introduced a growth account executive overlay team to sell into the install base who we partner with. We do CSQLs and other things to generate revenue for them, but not directly selling. So we've done both. The way we segment our business here is based on the number of stakeholders, shareholders on a cap table. That's how our contracts are set up. So if you sign a contract with us, you're usually in a tier of 1 to 25, 25 to 50, et cetera, et cetera. And that's how we price you. The package and features that you are sold into are relative to the actual size of your cap table. Renewal happens once a year. We snapshot your cap table. We charge you based on where you are in those tiers. So 1 to 25 shareholders, if you will, is our SMB segment and is currently run by a team of folks in our Rio office in Brazil. Mm-hmm. Our 26 to 300 is our mid-market segment and largely distributed across San Francisco, New York, some remote and some smaller offices. And then 300 plus is our enterprise segment. And so it's not the segments themselves, the naming convention pretty common. I would say it skews on the lower side relative to other companies because a 26 shareholder company that's in our mid-market book is still very much a small founder-led company.
Yeah.
And the mid-market is by far our biggest segment. As you can tell, they're where most of our customers sit. But it's also where a lot of our customers have their maturity moment where they raise around and start to grow and take off and where their engagement with the product takes off and where they need us the most.
Yep.
So that's by design that we have that segment so heavily skewed towards the mid-market part.
And then are you moving towards the common motion we see a lot of companies moving SMB segment of like more of a scaled model or a digital model where instead of having one-on-one relationships, like there maybe is a pool or something like that? How does that work?
Yeah, we've done that a couple different ways. And we've always, let me start by saying we've always had to take that approach to some degree. The size of our install base next to the revenue that comes along with it, it's a low ACV product. And that's, it's great. I mean, if you ever use Carta, again, from either side of the business as an administrator or as a shareholder, or if you are in our fund administration side of our business and use the software over there, I think it's very clear that we have incredibly strong product market fit. We've built a very well-designed lifecycle-based business. But the challenge with it is it doesn't become daily use until you get to enterprise. And next to other software tools in your stack, it's probably one of the least expensive. And because it is such a low ACV, not high transaction, but just low ACV but high volume of customers, we've always had to take a scaled approach. We have done digital things here for years. We will always have to do them. SMB and mid-market, just we have thousands of customers for every CSM that's in the book today. Yep. So we've been engaging on that level for quite a while. Mm-hmm. We've used technology to help us with that over the years. We started with your sort of basic like spreadsheet to Salesforce and then Salesforce to Catalyst and then using Catalyst again today. But we've had to find, and I say this a lot to people, like understand the moments that happen to your customer really well. Technology can help you to some degree, but if you don't know the moments, it doesn't matter whether you use technology or nothing, you're going to miss. So we've had to use that scaled approach for a very long time, and we continue to. And outside of enterprise, it will be the reason that we succeed or fail, is knowing those moments, knowing what happens once a year, once a quarter, twice a year, what the venture-backed life cycle looks like, because we are one. We've modeled it after ourselves.
Yep.
We know those things that happen, and we use the technology to help us scale programs where our intent is to get there right before the moment happens and give some education that, you know, again, if you do it right, it leads to revenue, either now or in the future. I have no preference between the two of them. Even when we were directly responsible for upselling, my perspective is like, you get the sale when the sale's there. if you do the engagement right, it will come to you when the time is right. Mm-hmm. But it's all about those moments and getting going through your product, understanding in a non-daily use way, which is a very hard constraint to work with. You don't get to work with the things that some digital SaaS companies have at their advantage, where you see logins and things that happen, MAU, like we can't operate with those metrics well here. Yeah. So you have to really dig in and understand behaviorally what a life cycle is, get ahead of it, and mm-hmm. use the technology to help you scale and get communication out to larger swaths of customers ahead of something that's about to happen. And if you engage with them right, they recognize you understand the business, you build relationships, and over time, the opportunity for them to, when they go raise a round and start hiring and need something more from you, it comes back into you more like an inbound motion.
Yeah. So I want to dig into that a little bit more, because I think, you know, a lot of customer success teams are often seen as being reactive, right? Mm-hmm. And I would like to dig into what you're talking about, like the moments that matter, understanding that the venture-backed sort of customer lifecycle in order to be more proactive and really try to drive growth. So maybe talk a bit more about how do you design your organization to be proactive, and what are some examples of those moments that matter in your business that your team could use?
I'll give you a couple of examples of that. We've done a lot of the work for our teams here in many ways. It's not that we farm lots of ideas from our ICs and managers across the organization. We always will. That will always be part of it. But what I did when I got here was very much try to start to tee them up. Some of them were what you would consider to be like more traditional upsell motions, like customer A and customer B look like each other in these two ways. They should have the same features. Try to sell customer B what customer A has. But what we did was we started to think about what are the implications of not having B in their success as a business, not whether they should buy it or not, because on paper, they look like somebody should have it. If you haven't bought 4.9A, and you're not using S4/4.9A, do you have a current FMV on file or no current FMV on file? If you don't have a current FMV on file, are you actually issuing securities or not issuing securities? You start to create these sort of matrix correlation things to the two of them, and you realize really quickly some of these companies are hurting and maybe have not raised money and are in a position where they might need something else from us. But some of them have bought something and not used it. So you can go into understanding how to get somebody back on track for something that they should be doing that they haven't. Mm-hmm. So some of those things are, and those are not new, common, like new, wildly controversial or interesting ways to do things. But what we have done is start to think about earlier stage companies, things like you create a new share class in the platform, you start creating draft issuances, doing things that are like modeling what could look like something is about to happen, recognizing what those things are in the right sort of appropriate way, reaching out to suggest that you like somebody might be growing and about to do something. How can we help you? Mm-hmm. How can you think about the next thing that you're going to do? What else should you be doing after that next thing happens that you don't know now? So you can start placeholding future conversations pre and post event in that way. So share class creation is a very common one that we use early. It's usually a very clear sign that somebody's about to make a change to their cap table. We're aware of that. We reach out, we engage. Okay. As you get later in the life cycle, and this one we figured out a while ago, was like we moved into a multi-product world. We built a compensation product on top of our cap table software. We started selling into a new persona, which would be like usually we're in the office of finance, so the CFO. We moved into the people team, the people ops and HR. Need to figure out how to sell and think about behavior that's happening in a different world there. What we started tracking against was like changes in company admins that happen under certain circumstances where you might think this is indicating they're going to do something next. In that case, for total compensation, somebody comes in, you think they're on a planning cycle, they might be interested in thinking about a solution for that that they weren't thinking about before. Or if it's a later stage company who adds a new CFO to the company admin page, triggering sort of introduction and like a whole series of education things that a late stage private company should know that they don't know. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's not good. Sometimes this is not new in software. Somebody changes, you lose your champion, you lose your company admin, you lose your advocate. Sometimes that comes under circumstances that are not necessarily going to be a good outcome. But the quicker you know about them and the quicker you take action on them, you know what the potential things are that could be discussed at that moment in time. It's not please let's talk and buy something, or hey, your renewal's coming up, or let's talk about why you didn't do X, Y, and Z. It's a education opportunity. Welcome into this ecosystem. You've either been in this ecosystem before with different lenses and know this and just are thinking about it through a different company lens, or you are new to this ecosystem, you really don't know what you don't know. let me like give you a full, like, this is what you should be thinking about as a Series C company that just came into Carta. We recognize what you've already done on the platform, what we think companies in that stage should be concerned about.
Yep.
A year from now, 2 years from now, 3 years from now, helping you think about the end of your life cycle now rather than thinking about that 6 months before it happens.
Yeah, well, that's great. It's almost as if you're advising your clients on what they need to know before they even need to know it.
If we're doing it right, that's exactly right. Absolutely. Yeah. And it is hard because at that scale of customers with a smaller CSM team than you would think for a company of install base of that size, you're certainly going to miss. So the moments are why it matters, and that's why the scaled technology helps, is that we can take a scaled approach here and be right 80% of the time mm-hmm. on one of these things that's going to happen. Mm-hmm. For some of the other parts of the organizations that are looking for upsell opportunities, we can get the triggers right on those things. But the real important point today, I think, that you just made there is if we're doing this right, we are leaving you with something you didn't know before,
yeah.
and we are helping you plan using this mm-hmm. software tool. Mm-hmm. If we're doing it wrong, the transaction's already happened.
Yeah.
And it does happen to that 20% of our install base. They don't engage for whatever reason. In some of those cases, when, as an example, a company admin changes, they come in, they replace it with somebody who has used another tool, but also common in the software world to see that stuff happen. So we won't get it right 100% of the time, but our goal is really to try to get it right more often than we don't, and mm-hmm. to leave our customers with some sense of like, hey, I wanted to talk to an equity professional, if you will, not tax advice equity professional necessarily, but like, how do I think about the things that I need to do as a venture-backed company with the people who know more about it than anybody else.
Yeah.
If I didn't leave a customer with that experience afterwards, then we had an opportunity to do better.
Yeah. So let me ask you a question about that. And I don't know if this is true, but I'm going to make a hypothesis here that the different personas that your team engages with is probably different than maybe an initial land, right? In initial mm-hmm. land, you might be dealing with the CFO and some of the executives and maybe the controller, maybe some people at some mm-hmm. senior levels. And then once they come on board, they delegate that down to an admin of some sort, and mm-hmm. that's who your CSMs are primarily working with day to day, week to week, month to month. So as mm-hmm. you think about how you make sure that you deliver that right content to the right persona, mm-hmm. it can be difficult, right? When we don't have that engagement with those personas that have changed in the post-sale. Am I accurate here? Is this similar challenge that you're facing as well?
Yeah, absolutely, 100%. And it's funny because in some ways, if you think about because we have this lifecycle business that technically in a lot of ways has a beginning, a middle, and an end. Mm-hmm. Many companies at the beginning don't raise money in SMB and don't make it at all. But you have this like two guys in a garage IPO on two ends of the spectrum, right? The two guys in the garage, it might be two guys and might have CEO, co-founder, CTO titles where you're talking to the two guys who both wear all the C-level hats. Mm-hmm. And then as they go graduate through the life cycle and to your point, start to hire and delegate down, you in the middle of our book where most of our customers live, you're probably talking to a controller or like a stock plan admin or somebody of that nature who is a functional owner and power user of the product, but not a decision maker at all.
Yeah.
And then as you get later, it kind of flips back up. You start moving back up the ladder because the implications of the actions that they're taking as a business and what they use our platform for are closer to a material event of an exit.
Right.
And they start paying more attention. So you go back to talking to a VP level plus, and if it's a liquidity event or something like that, then you are talking to the CFO again.
Yeah.
So it's like CFO over here, CFO over there, never in the middle, right? Except for a biotech company who's growing very fast. So yeah, we do. Well, that changes quite a bit. So it actually relates to the conversation about life cycle that I've mentioned earlier, which is that recognizing who your persona would be for SMB in 1 to 25 and what you look like pre-series seed versus post-series seed, what everything looks like post-series A. When you start to get that first big batch of hires is when we first built our total compensation tool and started selling into companies that were rapidly hiring and growing. You probably didn't have an HRIS connected to your platform to care about this problem until you raised a bunch of people, you had a bunch of new hires, which Series A is a big moment for a lot of companies in that world where they hire batches of 50 plus people. So yeah, we do have to track the persona carefully. This is something we've worked on with marketing for years, trying to make sure we understand that persona that changes over the course of a life cycle. And part of that concept of having like trigger notification of change in company admins and things of that nature does matter around material events, but it also matters just to understand, to make sure we are talking to the right person mm-hmm. and that we're spending our time with the right level person, bringing that level of education to that right level of person.
Yep.
We have a community platform. We want to make sure we introduce people to the right community forum to talk to other people like each other, but you have to know which persona you're talking to. So I would say we have a pretty good grasp on where those things sit typically. We have enough of a data set at this point, having done this for as long as we have, that we can pretty well know if it's a series seed minus company, who you're probably going to be talking to. If it's the founder persona, we know how to do that well. As a matter of fact, we actually call our SMB segment the founder success team for that reason. Mm-hmm. We were very aware of what founder journey looks like versus mid-market and beyond. So that is a very accurate observation.
And so then your moments that matter, right? I think there's ones that where we go, look, here's an opportunity for us to service the customer, to help educate, I would say more on the educational side. Mm-hmm. But then there's the ones where it's like, that might be ripe for a cross-sell or an upsell opportunity, right? What strategies do you put in place to identify those upsell or cross-sell opportunities? Mm-hmm. Does it differ because you understand that life cycle, which ones are the upsell or the cross-sell? Maybe a little bit more about how you're thinking about that.
Yeah, I think there's some places where they are the same. And I say this often, and I really do believe, as somebody who's done pre-sales, post-sales in my career, I do think if you're doing it right, they are mostly the same. If you know the life cycle, and I've said this many times also, I think the revenue is the result of the engagement. It's not the purpose of it. Mm-hmm. If you're doing it wrong, you can treat this like any other new business cycle of at-bats and number of emails it takes to get an opportunity. And we've had to do that too to drive revenue. We are still a growing company that needs to drive more top-line revenue growth. We still do that now. But I would argue that to some degree, the events are the events, and whether it's an upsell or not, if you do it right, the money will come in. Mm-hmm. We also have in Acarta, this is an advantage of ours, as building this the product that we built here, we have compliance-driven products, which a lot of SaaS companies have some version of that.
Yeah,
we know what the implications of not doing something are. We know what happens when you get to a certain stage and you should be thinking about stock-based compensation reporting. And when we get to that window, and we know something, again, back to education, we know something you don't know. Hey, you're a 75 shareholder company. You're probably not audited yet, but you're going to be audited. Mm-hmm. And when you enter that stage of your life cycle, it's going to be not an option whether you have a software to help you with this.
Yeah,
you're not going to want to be doing this through Excel or through a law firm or somewhere else. This is the place to do what you need to do. Mm-hmm. And so when you hit those compliance hurdles and life cycle moments, we're very clear, hey, we're advising you, but also you got to buy this. And those moments actually are fairly easy in that way. When we hit the compliance trigger moments, they're good. It's pretty clear, especially when if you get ahead of that moment, they tell them something they didn't know. It provides a detailed expectation of not just what the software will do, but what audit defensibility means if you buy this software tool through us versus mm-hmm. trying to do this yourself. Mm-hmm. You start to hit on the right pain sensitivity, the timeline. It's very easy. You're more than likely talking to the person who's going to feel the pain the most if it goes one way or the other. It's a beautiful thing when you have compliance products because you have this sort of pre-moment pain, during the moment pain, post-moment pain, where all those things technically would fit the category of when somebody would want to buy something from you.
Yeah.
It is very much about the moments, and even the cross-sell products that we built here, our Carta Total Compensation tool, we built an equity advisory product and service that we use around tender offers and things of that nature where you as a shareholder probably have lots of questions about exercising and wanting to talk to a tax professional. We built that into the motion as well. So I would say it is a mixture of things where if you have the moments right and the engagement right, more often than not, you're going to find an upsell opportunity. And what I've coached the teams on here forever is just because you get to the moment faster doesn't mean you're going to get the revenue faster. And you shouldn't conflate the two things. Mm-hmm. If you get to the moment at the right time, every once in a while, sure, but you're going to get it. Yeah. But if you get to the moment early, then ideally you have told somebody something they should be planning for. And then you're not worrying about budget for an upsell either because mm-hmm. you've planted the seed with them ahead of the moment, sometimes 3 to 6 months before the moment happens. Mm-hmm. Then when the moment happens and you're talking about a relatively low dollar amount of an upsell here at Carta, it's not a massive ACV increase. But you're talking about something that they no longer have to budget for because they knew about it 6 months ago.
Right.
You're not trying to get to them right at the moment that it happens when they're like, oh crap, I got to buy this thing. I don't have budget for it. My boss is going to kill me. You want to help them help themselves.
Yeah.
And so I do think the engagement is the point in getting that right a couple of clicks ahead of whatever is going to happen next.
Yeah.
The revenue comes back in when it needs to and when it naturally settles. We have some people on our team here from the early days that are still here. Actually, one of them is a senior manager on the team. Another one of them is on our enterprise team the like build a pipeline in the first couple of years was fascinating to watch the two of them. And their philosophy was, I'm just going to take every single conversation somebody will give me. I don't care what it is. One of the guys actually was in our Utah office at the time where a lot of our support teams sit. And he, if he didn't understand what something meant, he would just walk over to the support team and ask them, "What? Hey, this customer just said this. Tell the customer, hold on a second. Walk over to the support team. Hey, what does that mean? Hey, I got an answer for you." They just took every call they could get. Yeah. Some of them hard, some of them terrible, some of them just getting yelled at for whatever reason. But they built this rapport, understanding of their customer's life cycle and trust and engagement. And all of a sudden, I looked down in the summer of 2019. I remember one moment, it's just like these two guys were like 4x pipeline of everybody else. And it was very clear to me all of a sudden. It was like, well, you guys are getting this engagement thing right. Mm-hmm. You're not building pipeline intentionally. You're building pipeline through a relationship.
Yep.
And understanding your customer moments. And every one of these conversations is a notch on your belt of your further understanding of a life cycle.
Yep.
And then they helped us build the playbook triggers and the things that we use for everybody else now. And that motion and model, I think, is what makes people successful, is thinking about pipeline for an upsell, for cross-sell.
Yep.
Not as what is that buying moment, or even are you thinking about the buying trigger in the right way? Did you get to that moment 3 months before the buying trigger happened? Because if you did, there's a pretty good chance that if you educated them on it, when they're ready, they'll come to you.
Yep. Where is the source of truth for a lot of this engagement that happens? Is it within your Catalyst platform? Is it Salesforce? I guess that was the first question. Part two to that question would be, if you look at the different sources of information that can help us identify these triggers, where do those come from?
Yeah, they come out of our product. They come directly out of our product. And what we did in early 2020 was, it was very clear to me that the Salesforce integration through our platform was not going to be strong enough to get this done. And also, again, not controversial, but Salesforce by itself as a standalone for post-sales teams, maybe not the most effective thing. So we bought Catalyst in early 2020, set up an Amazon S3 bucket, started passing stuff through Cardiff backend administration, through the S3 bucket into Catalyst, run a bunch of playbook triggers off that. We used Catalyst for a couple of years. We outgrew it pretty fast. We moved over to Tango. We were there for a couple of years, came back to Catalyst, and then the two of them merged. Now we've got all of them. Right. Sounds like best of both worlds. It is. I'm very fond of both of those products. I know the founders on both sides of that very well. So by and large, the source of truth for what we take action on, and the source is Carta backend. The tool that we use to resource that is all coming out of Catalyst. So we've run all these playbook triggers out of Catalyst. Catalyst now allows us to, and this is very helpful for us as a scaled team. One of the things that wasn't true in 2020 that is today is that it triggers emails itself out of the platform. You can run the whole logic tree out of Catalyst itself. You create the moment, it hits the trigger. The emails themselves run through Catalyst. The tasks that go to the CSM come out of there as well.
Yeah.
So all of our data moments that happen, we pull the right moments, and we have a long running list that we use that we started with probably in 2020 and is now much, much, much longer, that goes through our data team, and they add it to the S3 bucket, passes through into Catalyst.
Yeah, interesting. Your business is very interesting because I don't think a lot of the traditional B2B SaaS metrics that maybe a customer success organization could use, like product adoption or consumption, like that really doesn't apply so much in your model. What are some of the leading indicators that show we are mitigating churn, we're delivering value to the customer that maybe you don't have available to you because of just the nature of the way your business is?
Yeah, so you're 100% right. And I think to some degree, for a while at the very beginning, it was hard. I thought about these things like it's gone back and forth between being an opportunity and a handicap. Depends how you look at it. I think in my mind, it forces me to continue to be creative and thinking about things that maybe are a little bit easier. Software tools like Catalyst and Tatango and the other ones that are out there in the world, or Gainsight for that matter, if you do have those, like a more robust traditional SaaS business, you can rely on those adoption metrics like that. I mean, you could set up things that I can't do at all here. So it's interesting. Let me put it this way. We are now, for the last couple of years, have been very much an NDR-focused organization. And I say NDR because certainly gross churn is part of that. But net result is what we care about. It's the thing that our board cares the most about. And it's what collectively, whether we are directly upselling or responsible for CSQLs or not, it's all NDR to me. It's all the customer experience, keeping the revenue growing that matters to me. One of the ways that we've thought about churn reduction in the last couple of years and retention as an outcome, as those levers of NDR during an economic downturn, is thinking about the controls that we have around commercial interactions, things like discounting, things like introducing price increasing initiatives and escalators, things that affect the dollars. But in terms of the actual leading indicators and KPIs that we think about, a lot of times these are broader, I mentioned this earlier, but like a matrix of combination of product adoption things that hit each other at the same time,
yeah,
that are usually an indicator that something we need to be talking to somebody about something. In our cap table platform, we do have this securities accepted and issuance concept here, where if you're not issuing as a company, there's a reasonable chance that you're not raising and probably not growing. If you're not accepting on the holder level, there's a reasonable chance that the program itself is not successful internally. If you have this combination of accepted and sent as a leading indicator for something, 409A is one we use often here. If you're keeping yourself compliant and have an FMVA file every year, we understand that you're an active company. If you have a 409A subscription with us and you're not using it, there are very broad stroke product adoption things that if combined with each other,
okay,
we think are indicators that we should be talking to you. Sometimes it's about adoption itself. Like, you're not using this tool, you're not in compliance, you need to use it. Sometimes it's you're not using this, oh, maybe you churned. You're not using both of these things at the same time and you haven't for 6 months, there's a pretty good chance you ran out of money and we probably should send a different type of message to this customer that's sensitive in a different way. And then as we start moving further up market, we get into a little bit more like traditional product adoption metrics, things that are more related to what we've surfaced what we call health checks here. There's probably hundreds of them in the world, but the ones that we care about the most are like the top 15 that keep your cap table ready for a transaction. So we use those as leading indicators. If you're keeping these 15 health checks in order, there's a reasonable chance that you're probably thinking about a transaction, a big one. Mm-hmm. How do we think about like things like keeping your HRIS connected and keeping your cap table correct as it relates to your HRIS and like stakeholder addresses and all those things that matter connected to each other?
Yeah.
Those are probably also, you keep those up to date when you're getting ready to run a transaction. So we do have some version of that today. But ours ends up being either like a matrix combination of things. We know what this probably means. We're going to use this type of outreach. And if we think it's a bad outcome, because churn is a part of our business that sometimes we can't control. Mm-hmm. Overwhelmingly, we're talking dissolution, M&A, and IPO are drivers, the biggest drivers of churn for us.
Yep.
If dissolution is one that we can identify, we can treat those customers in a different way. It doesn't mean we don't treat them. It means we treat them in a different way. If we hit leading indicator that means we think means you're out of money or you might be running out of money, we're going to reach out to you and talk about something different. If we think you're doing something behavioral in the product that looks like you're cleaning up and getting ready, maybe you need help with the cleanup. Mm-hmm. And we can help you clean that up. But we have to think about those things as like combinations of things that happen concurrently or sequentially as opposed to just standalone like, this company like had this many of active users that spent this much time in the product. Like we don't, those things are not useful for us.
Yeah.
If anything, I remember talking once, ironically, I think it was actually one of the co-founders of one of our vendors who oftentimes they're customers, of course, right? My introduction call with this individual, I was on a call and I think he said to me, he's like, hey, before we like get into this whole thing about us working together, vendor relationship stuff, he's like, can I give you some feedback about Carta? And I was like, sure, love to hear it. He's like, I love your product, but you don't get me to use it enough. And when I get in there, super easy, I get what I need and I get out of there. But he's like, you don't get me to use it often enough. And I said, I was like, feature or bug? Do you want to use it more? Is there more that we can do to educate you on things that you don't know about? Or is this just right on time for you? Because there's ways to think about that answer that are different for each customer. And it's okay, actually, if the answer for a lot of our customers is right on time.
Yeah.
When you need it, it's there. The people that you need to support it or have given you what you need to educate yourself right before it. If something happens right after, you know how to get a hold of your CSM. Our support team is amazing. Like those things can also be true and be fine, but it always hits you when you're like, oh, wow, somebody just said that to a founder of this company said this to me. We're doing something wrong. We got to get this right. Like we got to get them drawn into the platform and brought them in there. But when you're like, then you're looking at the actions they need to take, it's like, well, we could probably actually help educate you without getting you to log in.
Right. Exactly. And it goes back to, is this a sample size of one that might be okay, maybe it's an insight, but is he or she a unique outlier compared to the rest of the group?
Yeah, we've had to like really pile these things up over the years and I've been fortunate enough, especially with my leadership team here, a lot of the folks in my organization who run the implementations and support and CSM functions, some of them have been here longer than I have. My senior director who runs the CS function under me has been here working with me now for over 5 years. We've worked through these things together. And again, it's nice being a venture-backed company who runs that similar life cycle. We can use our own experience to understand what would a Series E company, who would, what would they need and why,
yeah,
versus where we were when I started here and where our CFO was probably still a user of Carta. Not true anymore, right?
Yeah. So to build on something you just said, which is we look at these matrix of signals or matrix of triggers, mm-hmm, and then earlier in the conversation, because you've got 30,000 customers and you only got so many CSMs that can support that, like you probably look at certain triggers or things that happen that require an in-person white glove touch as opposed, mm-hmm, to a digital touch, right? So, mm-hmm, somebody running out of money, yeah, we probably don't want to set up a digital communication on that. We probably, yep, want to have a conversation. So, yep, how does that feed into the playbook that you've designed as far, yep, as knowing when do we apply the white glove service as opposed to the digital touch?
Yeah, so one of the things that we did, and I say this sometimes like it sounds worse than I mean it, we're always in a position to have to scale non-linearly here. And capacity, headcount capacity specifically, will probably always be a constraint for us. I'm aware of what it is, it will always be that way. We'll never be able to do white glove across 90% of our install base. Mm-hmm. With that in mind, what we did this last year, and I think we're still like trying to optimize this as best as we possibly can, we've taken mid-market as an example, where the mid-market CSM most likely in their named accounts has 1,400 accounts. Okay, so we're talking very scaled.
Yep.
We have identified within those books high, medium, low touch customers. The high and medium, we take stuff that we have access to here, which is not sensitive or controversial information, but it's only the stuff that we would understand, like year over year valuation growth, stakeholder growth, time since last fundraising round. Like we look at all these things and combine them and say, this company, and also then map it against wallet share. If these three or four things are true, and you also haven't bought every software tool that's available to a mid-market customer, you're probably a high-touch customer. Mm-hmm. Mark them, stamp them, run, yep, playbooks against it.
Yep.
Medium is like, you made three out of the four, and last raise was this amount of time. Like, we create a set of criteria, and we mark and stamp them, we run playbooks off of them. So your mid-market CSM have 400 combined high and medium touch customers that we try to engage with, especially high touch customers. Those are EBR candidates. We should be doing EBRs with them. They still have not planned their exit. They're still growing. There's still opportunity to think about things that they should be buying, but also more importantly, like they're probably still tentatively thinking about what Carta can provide them that would help them, mm-hmm, because they're still growing. They're not running out of cash. They're still in a position where like the growth mindset is still part of the discussion. So we market stamp them and let them run in the background. There's a much more proactive white glove experience that comes from being a high touch mid-market customer than tech touch at the bottom. The tech touch ones, we let them run. We have digital engagement out there. Lots of inbound stuff comes in from those customers. Sometimes they're more support related. Often they are. Sometimes they're just subscription. And we do one-to-one subscription related help commercially to try to help them through situations that they're in. But we're often trying to like help get those people into the community platform and elsewhere. We have a whole library of digital to like 45-second video snippets to help train people on how to do things on their own. There are simple questions. Those are the ones where we try to get people into a cycle of helping themselves, but the higher growth customers and high and medium, that's one way that we do it. We've done something similar in enterprise where we have high and medium, high and low touch. It's the same thing. High is like markers for growth, haven't told us about an exit, still business planning with them. Mm-hmm. Those are your EBR candidates that want to discuss things with us. Mm-hmm. The low touch is ironic, are some of our biggest, highest paid customers. They get lots of touch from Carta, but it's usually more technical help that they need. Okay. So they'll get help from our enterprise support team. We have a technical like program lead management function in my organization as well. And the CSM is often involved, but like EBRs are a different thing for them. Their business planning and outcomes are already done. They have wallet shares expire. They've got everything they need from us. They just need us to help them optimize. Mm-hmm. It's those health checks I was talking about. It's like, did you clear the proper health checks to be ready for a transaction? How can we help you get ready for that? Yep. And the things that the people, the cast of characters that help that are more likely to be the rest of my delivery organization and not CSM, right, where the high touch ones are the ones where it's like, you have not decided what you're going to do in the future, or you're thinking about it and you need a partner to help you plan that. That's the EBR candidate. And those are the ones that want to have an EBR versus the ones who are like, here comes my CSM. He wants to have an EBR. Like, what are we going to talk about? It's a readout of metrics that I don't care about because I'm going to be gone in 18 months. That's how we've segmented our business to try to help that.
Yeah.
And we've done it and also to try to scale. Again, if headcount's going to be a constraint, and I think that's true for a lot of CS orgs these days.
Absolutely.
Trying to get smarter about how you can keep building books that like scale better in an automated way.
Yep.
If you could think about those markers that matter, that show you that a customer is still growing, and you know, it's not even the right amount of time, the right motion. Who's to your point? You don't want to send the wrong motion to the wrong customer. If you're sending it to into the ether of a customer that's not there anymore, it's a waste of a touch point. It's a waste of communication. But you're also opportunity cost missing the one who is growing and sending that to the right customer who does want to talk to you and does need your help.
Yeah. Well, so it sounds like you've got these personas identified. You've got the moments that matter identified to the different personas. But then you got to send it to the right person at the right time. And so that's where making sure that we've got the right data and the clean data. And we've had several conversations with folks who go, I got to rely on Salesforce data, but the data, the contact data is so bad, right, that my digital touch points are at risk of not hitting the right person if it's not there. So I'm curious how you all manage that sort of that contact management problem.
Yeah, we have the same problem as everyone else does, unfortunately. And I think part of this problem that we all live with here is that nobody knows what their company is going to look like when they're building their Salesforce instance. And the company admins on the Salesforce side oftentimes turn over the years. My almost 6 years here, that's changed several times on my end as well. So it's been hard because people don't know how to think about like related contacts and parent-child relationships and things like that until they happen. Their business model changes. All of a sudden, you're like, we're like getting into private equity now. Like now you have all these other types of contact relationships. We have a problem here where, especially on the venture capital side, since we sell into the fund administration world, we have portcos and funds. You have a person at a fund who could be related to multiple portcos.
Yeah.
And it's a very complex problem. For a long time, the way we solved it for our team, separate from marketing everywhere else who also has a version of this problem, is we just forced a once a month like SOPs task of downloading primary contacts out of sales, out of Carta and backend into Salesforce once a month. We've now since gotten a more automated way to make sure that the contacts are loaded. And now actually we've done that for different admin types because now we have HR and other admin types as well. So we have actually gotten a lot better. We have the same pain that most people do in that way. Mm-hmm. And there are some places where even with an automated outreach for some cases, if you're talking about a CSM driven playbook trigger hits for a customer who meets whatever criteria we've set up for this medium touch customer in mid-market, you still have to hit approved to send. In many cases, validating a contact would be a step you want to take if it's a sensitive thing.
Mm-hmm.
But I would tell you that like our business systems and SOPs teams over the years, we have gotten better at actually like forcing a constant sync between the two systems to make sure that at least we're getting the primary contact right.
Yeah.
If you're missing everything past that, that's a different problem. The other issue, and I'm sure lots of companies have this problem, primary contact is also self-controlled. We have that happens sometimes where somebody is not removed or changed as a primary contact. We do not know that. We are sending to the wrong person. We have that issue with billing as well, where our finance team is sending the wrong person. But we've had that problem for a long time. It's better now than it's ever been.
Yeah.
We do not almost never misfire to the wrong entirely. Sometimes we will have to cast a slightly wider net than we want to.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say the growth overlay team that's selling right now is probably doing what sales teams do and trying to hit everybody. But generally speaking, we do have the same problem that everyone else has. I've forced the issue first manually and then through our business systems and SOPs teams to at least map against the one primary contact.
Yep.
If that's all I get out of it in the end, I would live with that. If we get it to the one right contact, or more importantly, don't hit the wrong contact,
right?
Which is really what you're trying to avoid, right? And again, if we have like sensitive communication things that go out sometimes that are not just general day-to-day engagement things, those ones we will tend to do a more detailed scrub of. We have a customer comms person within my organization who helps with PMM overlap and reach when we're doing outreach to customers, can do a quick scrub of the list and we know what we're looking for to map it. But we've had, unfortunately, a struggle with that problem, like almost everybody, it seems.
Everybody. Absolutely. Yeah. It's one of those things where people have learned to live with it, although they know it's not where they want it to be. Right.
Yep.
Yeah.
No one seems to have really critically solved it for everybody yet.
No. Okay. So last question for you before we move on to what we call the lightning round, which is a little bit more personal. What haven't I asked you yet that I should have around how to proactively think about growth and engagement and customer success? Is there any topics we haven't discussed that maybe I should have asked you about?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I keep harping on the same thing here, and I'll just leave you with this, which is just that I'm just a firm believer in this. The engagement is what matters. Mm-hmm. And it's really hard to get it right and keep that front of mind, especially when you have revenue targets to hit. And that can be true. ARR growth is ARR growth. No matter where that is in the NDR equation, if you're responsible for it, it can be very tempting to go for the acute moments and look for those easy wins. And I don't think it's the easy work to go through the life cycle with a customer. That's the hard work.
Yep.
But that's how you get it right, and that's how it lasts, and how it builds a more like meaningful install base that's engaged more often than they're not.
Yeah, great advice. Okay, so let's move on to the lightning round. You've been there for almost 6 years. You've done a lot. You've changed a lot. What's the most favorite part of your job?
What's the most favorite part of my job? It's still the people. I'm very fortunate that I have teams across multiple different offices in a couple different continents, including Rio and Brazil. It is by far my favorite thing about being here is the people I get to work on the problem with.
Yeah, that's awesome. Okay, there's always a flip side to that question, which is what's the least favorite part?
Lots of change.
Yeah.
And that's true for lots of like startup type businesses that are out there. We change formations often. The change management is very difficult. And mostly because I want to make sure that it doesn't ever have an impact on our customers.
Yeah.
That's the hardest part to me is the change, and the part that if I could just snap my fingers and have it be the same, not be, and go away for a while, change for sure.
Yeah. Change. This is probably a two-part question. Change within the people on your team or change within like the your peers? Like what's the hardest part of change? Is it your cross-functional stakeholders or is it communicating the change and getting the team on board?
It's more cross-functional stakeholders.
Yeah.
You know, I guess there's a downstream of both, I guess, but really it's just it's hard. A company like ours has to change strategies often to continue to grow and scale. And as part of that, sometimes the cross-functional characters that you're working with change, and that part in and of itself is difficult to lean really too far into process because sometimes it will change again.
Yeah. Okay, so customer success as a function all of a sudden just evaporates from the world. There's no such thing as customer success any longer. What would you do in your career? Anything differently?
I do a lot of things differently. I've had many opportunities to do this differently before my like lightning round question. I almost went into rabbinical school out of college. I was a semi-professional musician. I've done a couple of things like that in my life, and I don't know that I would go back to either of those full-time, but I would get involved more into Jewish education and something that's important to me and my family, and probably go start a nonprofit or something like that.
Yeah, that's awesome. Yeah. Okay, last question. What advice might you give to someone who is CSM in their job right now and they aspire to be into leadership someday? What advice would you give them?
Well, first thing is I'd be ready to rethink what customer success is going to look like. And this is not an AI thing at all. I'm not worried about that as much for CS as I am in other places and thinking about that way. But to not be married to what a CSM job is. Be very flexible as things come at you and change. Yep. Be willing to think about the trade-offs of revenue accountability and revenue responsibility. And be thinking, honestly, this is maybe the biggest, most important thing. Be thinking through really critical fiscal lenses. We're all going to get put through the ringer here, and what customer success is and what value it brings, where it fits in a P&L is going to change over time.
Yep.
We have to be ready to start to show value quickly and recognize that the managers and leaders that you report into are also going to be in that same thing with you. So if you can adjust your mindset and recognize that that's what your manager is going to need from you and what their directors and VPs and C-suite folks are going to need from them, and be prepared to shift your mindset into CS not being a one-dimensional thing anymore.
Yeah,
I think that's where CSMs that are doing the job today will be future leaders in years to come versus CSMs who decide to do something else entirely.
Yeah,
because I think the role is changing quite a bit.
Yeah, no, I think that's incredible advice, and you're right. Take out AI outside of it. It's just there's so much change going on. You need to understand business, have good business acumen, understand how business works, and understand that what you're doing today might look very much different than tomorrow. Daniel, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Yeah, really thanks for having me.
We will wrap it up for another episode of the Revenue Lounge. Thank you, everybody, for listening.